This is CliffCentral.com.
Good afternoon. You're live with us on the Daily Maverick Show on CliffCentral.com. As usual, my name is Kingsley Kipuri, and I'll be with you for the next hour or so. I was away next week. Super excited to be back, as usual, chatting with you. And, of course, on Twitter, on @DMShowZA. Thanks for everybody who's already engaging with us there. Greg Nicholson, you flew solo last week. Thanks for holding it down. How are you doing?
Yeah, I might have to apologize to the listeners.
What?
I'm glad you're back. I'm not sure. Being a guest or sort of co-hosting the show is much easier than when you have to sort of press all these buttons and try to run things on your own. So I'm very grateful for you returning to the studio.
And you had the political weight of the country on your shoulders after the ANC conference and the SACP conference. So you had a lot on your mind, I assume.
Yeah, well, I'm glad today that we're going to be talking about something other than the endless stream of allegations of corruption and state capture or politics.
Absolutely. I mean, as Greg has already alluded to, we want to do something a bit different. I mean, aside from the hardcore political focus we usually do, and it's, I suppose you say it always sounds like it's another corruption scandal sometimes, and we're always trying to get to the bottom of things. We want to do things a bit different, a bit more personal, and we want to talk about parenting, something we're loosely calling quote-unquote woke parenting, and I know there's baggage with the term woke, but bear with us for now. But basically, how do you raise a child in for modern-day society and modern-day South Africa specifically? I mean, we talk a lot about all the issues around racism, around sexism, about inequality. We have the weight and the baggage of our national history, our continental history that we have to contend with and contextualize for our children. And then the day-to-day things that pop up, you know, something happens on TV, something happens at school, and how do you manage that? How do you explain that? So we have people who are a bit more qualified to talk about this than Greg and I are. So I'd love if you could just, you know, go around and introduce you, and then if you could contextualize us a bit about your household. So a bit about your child and or children and sort of the parenting structure, and then we'll go over from there.
And maybe the listeners should know that neither Kingsley or myself are parents, so we don't have a whole lot of experience in any of this stuff, so...
Okay. Perfect.
I like to think that we're still kids.
So you're taking notes.
That's right.
That's why we're doing this, actually. Okay, I mean, Leanne, you already started. So start with Leanne Naidu, who's an activist, PhD student, with someone we've had on the show before, and I'm really glad to have back. How are you doing, Leanne?
I'm well, thank you, cool. And hello to your listeners. So I'm in a same-sex partnership for the last 15 years, and my partner and I adopted our only child, Lerato. She's now 8 years old, and she came to us when we were when she was 4.5 months. Her entire life, she's lived in Johannesburg, although my partner and I have grown up in Cape Town. So that's just a snapshot.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll dig a lot more into it. Next up, we have Koketsu Moeti, someone also we have on for more of the political stuff.
So I'm a single mother. I've got two kids, one boy, one girl. Girl is the firstborn. She's 7 years old, and my son is 5. We're staying in Joburg right now, but stayed in Tshwane before and Mafeking before then.
Okay. You'll remember Koketsu as an activist, community mobilizer. She does a lot of writing also on this. I'm curious to see how that, you know, all comes together. And last, we have Danai Mupotsa, somebody I haven't had on before, but I'm glad the time has finally come. I should say Dr. Danai, I'm sure. doctorate in African literature, if I'm not mistaken, lecturer at WITS, does a lot of writing, and yes, talk to us.
So I have a daughter. She's 8. Her name is Mika. And I co-parent with her dad, who is an ex of mine, an ex-husband. So we have shared custody, and she is great. What more should I say at this point? Yeah, okay. We'll hear more.
I think you ought to say that with a lot more confidence.
She's wonderful.
There we go.
Yeah. She's definitely wonderful.
She's friends with Lerato.
Wonderful. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure for everybody tuning in and, you know, trying to make sense of the panel, the first thought would be like, what's going on? There are no men in studio aside from Greg and I, representative, and representative of, you know, a white family, and that's obviously something we're super conscious of. Did plan on having perhaps a more diverse and representative structure, and it just didn't come together in time. So I think our view is really to say we've got really interesting and cool people here. Let's use that and do that, acknowledging that it could be, you know, more diverse, and, you know, this is not the end of the conversation. We can continue this another time.
After, you guys should know, so after some of our plans for this show, some of the guests fell through. Kingsley thought, oh, you know, it'd be cool to get a white dad in. You know, we'll see how that works out in some of these sort of spaces. So he's asking me to message his just like white friends or people I know, men, and if they, because we don't really know that many people with kids where, you know, you just don't. and so I'm just sending messages to just random guys being like, hey, weird question, but do you have a child? And turned out none of them did. Oh. So we're stuck here as the male representatives today.
Okay. Koketsa, you've done some writing on this, and I'd just love to start with you. You mentioned in one of your blogs around a time when your daughter was discovering colors, and she would have new favorite colors, and she would say, this is my favorite color, and she got a pretty weird response from that from people at school based on what color she would describe as her favorite. Could you just talk a bit about that experience and what happened there?
Yeah, so you can see, because I have a boy and a girl child, in the way people talk to them, you get a sense of just how differently boys and girls are treated, right? So my daughter is older than my son, and I remember many times my son would be asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And my daughter is much, much older, isn't she? She's told you're beautiful, you know? You notice those little differences. So my daughter, as she was learning colors in creche, every new color, every week she'd basically have a new favorite color. Mm. And there was a time when she just, blue was her favorite color. And yeah, the sense was, no, but that's a boy color. It's not for girls. Girls should only like this. And I think that strengthens your resolve, the idea that my child goes out there into a world in which this is what they are getting feedback on. So the way I see my home, the way I think of my home is it's a place that should prepare them for dealing with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it should be almost like a sanctuary, a safe space where it doesn't matter all of the things people say, even if they tease you afterwards, it doesn't matter. So we don't do that. For us, there's no such thing as this prescribed boy colors or prescribed girl colors, toys, clothes, none of that. Whatever you like works.
Okay. Danai, just coming to you, I'm curious as to whether with your daughter there's a strong sense of you raising her as a girl and this means something, or are you more perhaps more open to...
I think when she was younger, and there was certainly when you give birth and there's a child and they're like, oh, a girl.
Mm.
People, there's, I think there was a lot more sort of color pressure for people, for gifts, and you know, so you ask people not to buy your child certain things and they still do, and they think you're being offensive when you say no, thank you. So there was a lot more. I think I was a lot more anxious about the things that she was exposed to when she was really little. But now that she's 8, so she has this really, I think she has a fairly firm sense of herself. I think I don't think that the you know, I don't not worry about what she's exposed to, but I think she has a sense of herself, and she has we've developed quite a sophisticated language about gender. So she can recognize when something is feminine, and she can use both languages, or when, you know, when something is kind of, you know, and she can think through how people have expectations. So I think we've incorporated it into our conversation in a way that's it, where she can recognize my discomfort and then draw her own boundary and say, well, let me just figure this out and I'll let you know. And then if she's talking to kids who may not know the same language, then she'll find a way to say, I don't like it, and then make a boundary, but in a way that's kind of aware of other people's experiences. I don't know. That makes sense.
That sounds incredible. Leanne, is this something you face in Lerato?
Mika is incredible.
Okay. You're affirming this.
So, Lerato, I'm as you can hear, kind of gender non-conforming in my voice and my appearance as well. People often don't know how to place me in terms of gender, race, etc. And I, because we're two women who are parenting, Lerato's had the pressure from school and from others around this dad question. And from a young age, when she'd say, introduce me as her dad, and sometimes say, call me dad, I would just respond to that and be happy to be dad. So I get Mother's Day cards and Father's Day cards, which is great. And what I've found that she's done is that she, when she's, depending on who she's with, who she's going to go on a play date with, or whether we're going to an LGBTIAQ event, she will experiment and play around with things. So sometimes when people are checking in with their preferred pronouns, she would say, I'm he today, or I'm a they today. And this is not an unusual thing for her. So she experiments broadly.
Or with herself, with how she...
With herself, yeah. And she also does this with her clothing. So she will introduce herself as a him sometimes. And none of us freak out. Some of my family freak out. People generally
are overwhelmed by that kind of disruption. But in terms of gender, she's been doing that for a while, and she floats between things, and I'm so glad for it.
Jeez.
It means that she is going to experiment and do what she feels is necessary. Of course, she'll get flack. I mean, one of the difficulties of raising a child that is has kind of non-normative ideas about a range of things is that when she does come up against other kids who are either older or even parents who disagree, when she comes back to us, we've got this difficult situation of going like, okay. And the way we've spoken to her about it is, actually learned this from a friend of ours whose kids are a bit older, is to speak about it in the guise or using the phrasing of old ideas versus new ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So that you don't make it wrong or evil. We just say that these people haven't learned these new ideas yet.
Mm.
And so it becomes a way to kind of have the conversation, to be able to point out how we differ from other people. It's really difficult when you have an outspoken 8-year-old who goes up to a Tanya and says, listen here, you are wrong.
Those are old ideas.
You know what I'm saying? It's difficult, but yeah. I mean, it's really important. Also, if kids are going to be experimental and if they're going to push against the kind of problematic boundaries that we have, especially around gender, we actually have to give them the opportunity to defend their positions from themselves and not simply mimic what their parents do. And so it's cool to see a experiment with that. I worry about the times when we're not there.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's all parents worry, I think.
What about for yourselves, when you're confronted with perhaps family members or friends who don't see any value in challenging some of these gender stereotypes and say, you know, why don't you just let boys be boys, girls be girls? How do you respond to that criticism and pressure from, you know, loved ones or friends? Koketso, do you want to?
So I think for myself, I like this that Leanne was describing about old ways and new ways, right? Because at the same time, you don't want to create a situation where there's tension. You might die tomorrow. Your child's going to live with the very same relatives. So that's the kind of space you're navigating, the reality that anything can happen and change. So what I often find is that it's important for me, as much as, you know, I had to also challenge myself when my child back chats an elder, you know, there was always this, you know, for a moment you're like, oh my God, but you have to affirm it. And for me, when that happens, it's important for her to also see me do it, to stand up for the very idea that we've been speaking about, but in a way that does not vilify the other, right? Because bottom line, if I die tomorrow, that very same family member is going to be the one who takes them in. And I need my kids to understand that that's a person who's still stuck in the old ways. Maybe you can help her change, you know? And one aspect that I did find was very interesting with grown-ups, right, is the issue around consent. My kids know you're not forced to kiss, touch, hug anybody. I don't care how close they are to our family. It's always just been a given. And it's been, I think that was the biggest part that got pushback, you know, because people always expect, people think they can just come and put their mouths on your kids. And
could you explain the situation when that happened?
Like, yeah. So
family
we
gathering or what?
So we stay in Joburg, obviously. Yeah. We don't see our family quite often. So there was a time after we moved and the family came over to come say hello. And I remember one particular uncle of my mother who tried to kiss my child, and my child was like, no, you know, I don't even know you. And you could see the tension in the room. You could feel the tension in the room, you know. But it's important for me for them to know. And I think also at the same time, adults don't realize that kids are their own people in their own right and should be allowed to develop their own boundaries in their own right.
Guys, we all know about, all families have those uncles. Hey, we have to talk about it more often. I remember the uncles I used to just sidestep. But now with kids where you give them the opportunity and you affirm for them that they don't actually need to present themselves in any kind of way to an adult simply because they are a kid and the adult is an adult.
Oh.
So, I think I would have loved a parent who would have affirmed that more, because everyone jokes and laughs about the uncle who gets drunk and then smooches you.
Mm.
But actually it's really not okay.
Then I saw a strong nod from you on this. Is this something?
Yeah, I was like, I'm like a parent. I don't like uncles. No. I mean, but I think I guess from my daughter, because she has me in my sort of my home, and then 50%, and then she has her dad and his context, and I don't even, I can't, I mean, that's like, I don't know what happens there.
Mm.
But I have no. I have to concede control, and I think so. Part of it is trust. I think. that she has such interesting ways of managing everyone's hopes and wills and wishes and expectations in a way where her own are at the ground of it. So I think there might be different kinds of expectations around her gendering and being cute or pretty or helping with certain things in the home that are about being a girl. And I think that part of me is like, well, how do we have the kind of conversations where so she'll say, Mama, I want to learn how to cook this, and it'll be because she's like, well, you do it in a really delicious way, and I also want to learn, and then we can talk about cooking in a way that we can then say, move on to a conversation about reading, where forms of labor, like reproductive labor, that she would be taught to be a good girl in various kinds of contexts, are not just given. So I want her to think about it. I want to press questions with her, but I think I can also trust that she's, wherever she's mobile, that she's able to ask those questions. The other place where I think I struggle is with school. It's often my values are not necessarily the same values as the context of the school. And where she can be happy in a school, happy with some things, or confront her own battles in the school. So if she's uncomfortable, she can say, but she finds her own language. And so she sometimes will be uncomfortable with me making interventions because she wants to create space for different kinds of values to be able to help, to be held. And so I think there's a set of awarenesses around which, for me and her as parent and child, we then have an ongoing dialogue about I guess it's because the way she says, Mommy, not everybody sees things the way you do. Mm. She says, I'll defend the way you see things because, I see them with you. But she wants to, I think she often tries to gather space to hold everybody else, to hold people's things together. And then part of, I guess, what that means is me reinforcing for her and affirming her own boundaries, even with me. So part of it is that she must also have an implicit distrust of me, just like she has one of everyone else.
That sounds like a really sophisticated navigation of spaces and values by her.
Like, there's nothing to be trusted. The first sense I had when I gave birth to her. I remember thinking, I can't be trusted, because it's a power relation. I'm the parent, she's the child, it's a power relationship. So she can't trust. She can't be, just leave me to do everything, even though she is dependent, and she must know she's my dependent. Mm. But she can't trust me.
I mean, that makes me think of one of the things that Kelly and I did from early on.
That's your partner, Kelly?
My partner, okay. Kelly, yeah. We were, we said to Lerato that it's basically her responsibility to make a good argument about something. And if her argument is good enough, then she overrules us. And that's, and as much as one can be democratic and hearing of one's child's visions and desires, one has to try to do that. And that worked when she was fumbling over words. But now as a 7-8-year-old, she's making really good arguments that sometimes I wish I could just be the kind of parents who would say, well, it's because I said so. But in growing these young kids for what's ahead of us in a very tumultuous South African society, trying to deal with racism, sexism, homophobia, all of it, and the huge class inequalities, I think it's really important that they learn to make good arguments from early on, and that we as parents are the ones who will struggle to be able to do that. But hopefully, when they leave and become their own adults, it would stand them in good stead in some ways. Yeah.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, I'm glad that you mentioned the idea of a tumultuous society, that sometimes is, physically dangerous. And you mentioned this with the dodgy uncles, I suppose, and the numerous other people who may want to cause harm to your children. And are there times where there's, and this to everybody, are there times where there's trade-offs between this idea or this way of parenting may be problematic? However, for safety reasons, this may just be something I have to do. So, you may have to dress a certain way like this. I know it's problematic, however, I'm just worried for you as my child. Have there been any trade-offs that have come off in terms of safety at all?
I think one of the things, before we even answer the safety question, there's constant negotiation, at least for me. I don't think there's a perfect way to raise a child in terms of what the parental involvement is. So I have a partner, we live together. Coquette's a single parenting, Denise doing 50-50. I think all of these bring a benefit and a challenge. And so for me, what happens is that negotiating safety with my partner, who's raised white middle class, who has a sense of safety that's very different to mine, who grew up on the Cape Flats, who came out of a family that was very involved in the anti-apartheid struggle, had a sense of state intervention into my home through the security police from a young age. So for me, I'm much more paranoid than my partner is around safety. And so the negotiation that happens, or that has to happen because there are two present partners, sometimes make this this questioning and decision a little bit more difficult. But I've always maintained that it's really important until my kid is old enough to not only be able to use the words but also physically be able to get out of a situation. I'm fairly protective over her. But the freedom, you asked about family and the imposition of family's discriminatory practices. You didn't know this, but our kids all play together. And
I did not know.
For me, family is not simply blood family. So I am relieved to know that I have a set of friends who have kids who are not only Lerato's age, some younger, some older, who have similar kinds of values and therefore a shared, what I would call safe space, even though you can't keep a kid safe always. And so I feel completely relieved to be able to know that Lerato will go with Danai or go with a friend, and that will be largely safe and have to be trust. It's very difficult for me to be trusting in that kind of way because of my paranoia, but because I've chosen family or chosen friends that stand in as more as family. So I would say that my kid plays probably more with my friends' kids than necessarily with my cousins' kids, as an example.
And at the end of the day, we know it's not just paranoia that you're fearing, because the statistics on issues of gender-based violence, abuse of young children, just violence in general against young boy and girl childs are very, very high.
Yeah. I do think that that's also important, right? The idea that parents are not only the people who have kids. Ultimately, when these kids are older, we're all going to have to live with them in a society, you know? So even if you don't have kids, my child could end up making political decisions that are going to affect you. So I think it is important that we see that child protection, this kind of society that we have, as one that is supportive of parents, of kids in difficult situations. As she spoke, you know, about, you know, teaching a child not to trust you even as a parent. We know a lot of harm is done to kids by parents themselves. So in a sexual nature, we know it's often men who are involved, right? But the reality is that women are the primary caregivers of the majority of households, and women, we can be abusive too in the emotional sense, in the, you know, in a variety of other senses. So outside of that, there needs to be a bigger, wider community. And I think even for parents themselves, you know, she's talking about like support structures. The support structure, we think about city life, you know, you're gone. Once upon a time, where I come from, when I had kids, I never had to wake up in the morning and think about childcare. It was a given. I had an entire community who could care for my kids, you know, which is very, very different from what you experience in Johannesburg. But the implications of the rollback of social support networks does have an implication on the parent who's raising the child. Do they have enough time to spend with the child if you're at work and so on all the time? Who's teaching your children these values? So it is really, really important that people do come to the party within the friendship circles and even beyond.
Absolutely. So I'm just curious, having a boy child, I'm curious as to whether there's an additional weight to navigate the pressures that masculinity brings, or perhaps even an additional weight of saying I want to raise a boy that perhaps is more progressive, that will never fall into the dangers of a lot of us men knowingly and unknowingly perpetrating violence, you know, later on in life. Is there an additional weight to that you find yourself thinking about or navigating?
Definitely. I think it's so, so important that the kind of behavior, you know, our children are learning from us all the time, you know, even when I'm not explicitly teaching, by watching me and my own behaviors with male colleagues or other people, they are getting something. So, yeah, there is a very deliberate attempt to try and build the kind of man that I don't want to see in, you know, outside in society. we use, I think our house is a house of stories, right? So there's a lot of books. There's a very deliberate, even the movies, there's deliberate choices are made. It's important for me, for my son, to see black, brown girls as protagonists, you know, to see, you know, the whole idea of boundary setting and so on, to understand that, you know, there's this sense of boys will be boys. It's none of that, you know. Boys will take responsibility in this house. I mean, even with the dishes. So I will wash the dishes, my daughter will dry, and he will pack. So it's important also that even the role, what we do within the house, is spread amongst us, not in a way that reinforces the idea of a particular gender should be doing this. Yeah,
absolutely. In one of your blogs, you mentioned a time where I think there was a break-in at your house, and this idea of how to affirm your children, and I think your son specifically was sort of challenged in that moment.
Yeah, definitely. So my son, some years before the robbery happened, had witnessed a violent scene. And I wasn't actually aware, but the robbery just really brought that back. And after the robbery, I remember, because I sent them to school, because, yeah, the house just needed to be cleaned up, and there was just no ways I was going to function with the kids there. And I just remember, you know, when they asked me, how was I feeling? You know, we hadn't really spoken about it. And I was planning, what am I going to say? You know, they listened to me. Should I say thank you for being brave? But then it struck me that my kids are going to get an idea that this means they must always be brave. Mm. This means that they cannot break down in a moment of fear, you know. So how do I do it in a way that... So I spoke to a lot of my friends about it, because I was just like, before they come to school, I need to have an answer.
Was it a fixed amount of time?
Yeah. So it was like, okay, so how do I affirm and thank them and say it was amazing that you reacted the way you reacted, that you listened, and that you were able to keep safe, you know. But at the same time, to say that you don't have to always be that brave. It's okay to be scared, and yeah. It was just quite a difficult thing to negotiate. But in the end, it worked out.
I can imagine. I'm curious about race. I know, Leanne, you mentioned just your upbringing and how it was just such a state intervention. It was just a thing that you lived with, and race was a thing that you lived with. Have you talked to your daughter about apartheid from a historical sense, or more about racism now? Is that something you guys have talked about?
I mean, just to say that we are... what in Afrikaans would be called a gemors in terms of racial, if you were to look at the constitution of our home. I don't identify as colored, but I grew up culturally on the Cape Flats. My partner's family is white, middle class, and Lerato comes from Soweto. So there is no way that we can have a transracial adoption and not deal very explicitly with the question of race. So we've always been open to not only talk to Lerato about racism in the current day, but also to be very clear about the history of South Africa with her. So we've always spoken to her about this. She understands.
Sorry, how did you do it? I just can't get off like how.
Well, I mean,
does one start?
I'll tell you. Let me tell you a little story that isn't specifically related to race, but that I think the lesson is similar. One of the very good things that the social worker advised us when we adopted her was to make sure that we talk to her about her adoption before she can even understand the words that we're saying, because this is you're normalizing what people would consider a difficult conversation. And fortunately, my partner and I have also had to be very upfront and very honored with the question of race, because neither of us are superheroes, and we also have internalized form. We grew up, we both 76 babies, so we grew up under apartheid and were formed partly by that, and me thankfully also by my family's anti-apartheid struggle or involvement. So we'd already been having the conversation around race before Lerato came into the question. But obviously, when you have a child that you have power over, and our specific makeup is such that she now has one mixed-race parent and one black parent. No one in our extended family looks like her. And this is a really difficult question to navigate. And some of the ways that we've tried to deal with that is to ensure that our chosen family doesn't only look, that is not simply high school friends and cousins, because then we would just be replicating what our families historically look like. But in addition to that, when we make the decisions about schools and where we live, for example, we make sure that that is a primary
it's actually the criterion that we use. And so Lerato goes to a school that is majority black, where she feels like she can see herself everywhere in ways that I think are really important for her. So both in the conversations and the willingness to talk about the baggage and the history, but also what's happening. So she will be able to tell you about, if you were to ask her, she'd be able to tell you about Fees Must Fall. She'd be able to tell you a bit about decolonization. She'd also tell you why Donald Trump is a problem. And I think we asked the question, someone said, actually some kids were talking. A couple, I don't know whose kids it was. They were talking in the back and I was taxi driving and listening. And someone piped up, is Donald Trump worse than Jacob Zuma? And Lerato's answer was, of course Donald Trump is worse. He's also racist. And then someone was like, but can't Jacob Zuma be racist? And there they go with this conversation. Wow. These are 8-year-olds. I mean, the idea that they can't understand concepts is just nonsense. It's what you're willing to give to them and how much space you're willing to create to have these difficult conversations.
Jesus, that's incredible. Danai, does Mika identify as black?
Yes.
What do you mean? Was it important to you that she knew you are black and this means something? Was that important to you?
Yeah, and I think I want to agree with Leanne. And for me, it's like the difficult conversations should be normal because I think that these kids, they walk in their bodies. They exist in this world. Mm. And so they're already experiencing. So I think it's really affirming to give someone language. It took me so long to have the language to explain. I thought I was crazy. It's like, what is happening? And so to have the language to say the reason things are looking, it's like, you know, this week, I mean, they were asked to make a wish for Mandela Day. And so I can make wishes because, you know, justice is a wish. And she's like, I wish people, we didn't have money. And so this is what she puts out of there. But I wish we didn't have money because money seems to be the root of what some people are on the street and some people don't have. And she, this is the language she used. So I'm like, this is an opportunity. So I pull out the book on Marxism and we talk about it because I wanted to have language to have to guide, you know, to sort of supplement her intuition. She came with intuition and I was like, yes. And she was also, she was also pointing out, she says, she was saying, it seems like people work without a relationship to thinking. That's the relationship word she didn't use. She said there's something about work and thinking that doesn't seem connected. And I was like, this makes sense because, you know, Das Kapital, as we name him now in the house, Das Kapital has organized it so that we don't think when we work. And money, and but also I wanted to think about money as the thing that we exchange between us that makes our life, that dehumanizes. Okay. Because she was making the connection anyway. Mm. So here I'm like, here are the concepts that came up in this book and we can talk about it tomorrow. And she's like, please come. We have a 6-week break, and I was like, okay. Mm-hmm. But I think complexity is important because I don't, and I think normalizing difficult conversations is important because I think that you know, Mika doesn't go to a majority black school. Mm. I made the decision because I don't like to drive far. And also, I was like, I don't like to drive fast. She goes to school really close to where we live. But also, actually, part of it was also that I'd gone to all girls' schools growing up, and I'd found them really extremely difficult for many reasons. But I'd felt particularly affirmed as a girl in terms of, so the minute I went to a mixed school, I felt, I felt like people didn't expect me to be as excellent as I could be. So there's an attachment that I need to work through to single-sex education that I think was part of my decision. But it also means that she's in contexts where those questions come up, and maybe if there's no language to say, if your ballet teacher talks about your bum, that's not about your bum. And so I want you to have the language to talk about it, so then we can talk about it. And she may not always...
So is that something that happened?
It's happened, yeah. So they were practicing, and I didn't even know... I still don't know how to bring it up with her, because I don't think she's... I think for her, she's like, she's like, I'm having fun, and I don't need to be the best at it. And so it doesn't have to be a difficult thing. But I'm immediately, like, watching this, and I'm thinking... And I know that if I bring it up, the parents may not understand what I mean if I'm like, it's a problem. I was talking to one of the moms actually after school yesterday, and I mentioned it, and she was like, oh yes, eating disorders and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Because, of course, as you know, children who dance, and increasingly there's an idea of what size they should be as they get older. And so she understood what I meant from the point of view of the size of people who dance. But I was like, but beyond that, there's a racial connotation to this, tuck your stomach in, tuck your bum in. But it seems like I'm making it up if I bring it up, right? So how do I have the conversation with the child without introducing a new problem to her life? But I'm like, but actually this is going to be there. So, but I haven't decided, I don't know how to you know, part of me is just like, can I get her involved in another extramural next year? And then they can just go away.
Can I just say that Lerato is at an all-black school.
Yeah.
And there are like a minuscule amount of white kids. Mm. But there is still the question around the hair.
Yeah.
It's amazing how powerful this kind of white middle class subject is in the imagination and in what kids see as the norm. So it's not that it doesn't come up, but it doesn't necessarily come up with the same power dynamic. Yeah. And so the relation is different, but you can't actually get away from it by choosing a particular school.
Especially because a lot of, you know, sort of the decent, what people say is decent schools, or where if you want your kid to get a fair education, even if they are now majority black students, a lot of the staff and the culture are hangovers from colonial and apartheid eras.
Totally.
One of the things I'm picking up from all of you, though, is that it seems crucial to talk about your children extensively about race so that they can both understand their own identity as well as the context and the society that they live in. But it reminds me of, I can't talk too much about white families in South Africa, but at least I grew up middle upper class in Melbourne, Australia. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why white families don't even acknowledge that we're white or talk about race at all. But when I think about just the context over there, but also if we're talking particularly about South Africa now, how toxic it can be to ignore these issues and how it can only perpetuate many of the challenges we have in our society by sticking your head in the sand.
And I hear you. So I'm curious what language you guys speak at home. Is it important that they speak multiple languages? Is there a bias to English being in Joburg? How do you navigate that?
That's been a huge thing, particularly post-school. So since moving to Joburg, when we stayed in Tshwane, I mean, everybody spoke it. So we moved to Joburg. Almost none of my friends, I only just have one friend who speaks to them in Setswana.
Yeah.
So there's certain things that I do. I've made a, because of school, Setswana starts when they're in grade four. So right now they can only do isiZulu. But at home, we speak in Setswana. I've had to make a conscious decision. So even this thing of grappling with concepts and whatnot, for me, it's important that they understand.
Also, you're doing the teaching that you mentioned, and you're also trying to make sure that can happen in Setswana.
Yeah, yeah. So we just talk about that. We have a lot of reading material. You know, Nali Bali was also, like, really amazing. And then another thing is just deliberately, it's important to me that they go home every holiday, you know, to go spend time amongst. The life we live in Joburg is so, so different from where I come from. It's important for them, for me, for them to see it, for them to be surrounded by people who speak Setswana all the time, you know. But particularly after school, once they start school, I've had to make more of an effort. Yeah, they'll come in and just start speaking, and then I'll be, hey, worrying, you know, what you're saying. I can't hear you. Just had to say that. Like, I can't hear you.
I don't
you.
Understand.
And it's just a very, very deliberate thing. So one of the rules I have is you don't correct my children's English. Mm. And for me, that's very important. If you are in our space, you don't do that. I don't send a message to my kids that speaking perfect English is the most important thing for you and your life, right? But it's also recognizing that if you look at the school they are in, the people we hang around with, they are going to speak good English eventually. So actually, let's just affirm what they do speak. Let's affirm their own language.
Hey, Leanne, I know you don't identify as colored, as you said, but is it? I know you wanted your daughter to be surrounded and see a lot of people that look like her.
Mm.
Is it then important for you that she's then connected to that in bigger ways, like speaking the same language, like being able to, you know, go to rural homelands? Mm. Do you add those additional layers, or do you think seeing it is enough?
No, you see, I mean, one of the things I think Kelly would agree with me on that we're failing, we're not doing as well as we should do is on the language question. So Lerato does get isiZulu at school. Kelly's conversational, and I can do basic stuff through courses, but it's not sufficient.
Mm.
We're actually going to be moving to Cape Town soon, and have agreed that one of the ways to go back to that particular city, which is segregated, problematic, and racist, is that we have to take more of a role in learning ourselves, so that, because Lerato's figured out that English is the power language.
Okay.
She really doesn't. She's even come home saying she's really excited about Afrikaans. So she wants to learn Afrikaans. And I'm just like, are you serious? You want to learn Afrikaans? I mean, we can both speak Afrikaans sure second language because of apartheid and what was forced. But it's not good enough. And we try to say the words to her that it's really important that you are able to speak a local language. But for her, it makes no sense to her. She's like, you're not making the effort. You're not making a good enough effort.
Why? Making sense, yeah.
So we have to make that commitment, which is really important. So that's our next hurdle.
Then you mentioned class, or rather Mika mentioned class, and that's how you brought up, managed to sneak in Marxism gently, which I still don't understand how one does that. Do you go to great efforts to try and position your family class-wise and trying to say we have certain things, other people don't have certain things, and therefore we should feel thankful, or therefore we need to work hard and keep these things? Is that something that you...
It's more like, how do we do the kind of work that we can make the inequality impossible? So I think the questions, I'm asking more radical questions.
Okay.
I think I wanted to ask more radical, because I think a lot of the conversations I have at school are very much like, life, it's so unfair, we should give more money to the poor. Oh, it's so unfair, poor people should somehow be raised up, as opposed to asking a structural question. So I think, you know, for example, there was formerly an abandoned, in quotation marks, building that's now been made into a private residence for UJ students close to the school. And so when the people who used to live there were evicted, we had a long conversation about, you know, how is this connected to exactly the, you know, where we live and how, you know, how we are able to be made to live in others. And last night she was before she went to bed, she started crying, and she says to me about the question of safety. She started crying, and I sort of was like, what? But we were doing so well. We watched Despicable Me 3. We had nice supper. I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
And then she says, Mama, I've been holding it in since basically 2015. I'm really afraid at night when I go to bed, because I'm scared someone's going to come and break in the house. And I was scared to tell you because I thought you'd be cross. So I was like, why would I be cross? Anyway, so I need to think about why she would think I would be cross. So I'm trying to tell her, you know, I'm the adult, so I should worry about our safety. That I don't want to say, you know, it's not, you shouldn't worry because there's no reason to worry. But then I also started to talk about, like, you know, what is crime? So what's the conversation about? How do we think about how crime materializes? How do we think about the structures of inequality that make it so that, you know, a friend of ours and her daughter had experienced a robbery quite recently, and it was a very little person who ended up breaking into the house. I'm like, how do we think about people who are also little, who end up, you know, who will end up as criminals? But which is not to say that we should then not be, you know, worry or want to protect yourself, but how to have all of those conversations in the same space and say, how do we think about a society where things are not fair, you know, and then how do we participate in a society where things are not fair? And I try to avoid, because she gets so much of this kind of sugary, the present is great, the past was terrible, and so much of the, we should be thankful for what we have and then hope that others have it too. I want her to understand the connections between the two things, and understand it as a structural problem, and understand that it materializes in our very capacity to have, and then, not to say then that she must be punished, but say then what do we do, and how do we participate in a world where we have to ask those questions?
That's a big task. Kokenso, have you faced the trade-offs that sometimes faces middle-income or middle-class families, where it's either you must feel super grateful that you're not living in poverty, or you must, you know, cling to what we have and work as hard as possible to be really rich? Is that something that you've...
So I think because of where I'm from, it's kind of what my kids, where they come from themselves and where we are now, they can see the difference. You know what I mean? It's a given. We live in a house now. They go home, and it's, yeah. And then also, because I'm a single mother, my kids go with me to work events a lot, you know? So my kids have been to Maricana. My kids have been, so they're quite engaged with the kind of things that are going on. So I do think that the conversation has been, the school has actually been very helpful. Okay. So their school introduced what's called the Critical Thinking Day. So it's an effort to try to get kids from different ages with their knowledge from in the school and outside to work together, right? Mm. So the first one they had last year was about how do you solve South Africa's water crisis? And then the other one was about inequality. And I really like that the school does do that kind of thing. Right now with the Knysna fires, you remember the Knysna fires? Yeah. There was a lot of conversation about this is how people are responding, but to other tragedies in in black communities, there is no response. That school has responded to others as well. So it's, yeah, I just feel like it supplements what we're trying to do at home. But I do think that also at the same time, I try to do it in a way that also recognizes that my kids should also just be kids. They are kids, yeah. You know. So some things, like with the race issue, for me it's about the storybook that shows black protagonists. They are getting the message there, and you can see it now.
But in a way, that's still, it's a kid and they're still having fun with it. Yeah.
But I remember when I was my children's age, every time I colored people, I'd leave them white and color their hair yellow. My children color people brown and black, you know, so they are getting a message. They are getting a message about black families and blackness and what it could be and, you know, and also what the material conditions are for many black people in this, you know, in this country. So I do think it is that negotiation of just also just recognizing that kids should be kids also. Black kids should not always be burdened to have to be like many social justice warriors from when they're kids. You know, it's like just about knowing this is your life, this is reality. How do you navigate? What can you do to make a difference? But also, how is that a part of just being a child?
I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, Leanne, last time we had you on, I think you had just come back from being on the flotilla, and I actually, how I found out you had a daughter is because you mentioned on the way out like it's, that there was a challenge in trying to explain to her why you had gone and why you coming back was such an event. And I'm curious if there's just tension there of just contextualizing the work you do, not putting her under pressure to now she must also then be a, you know, social activist, as you mentioned. And is there tension there?
I mean, the thing is, I continually through Lerato get to reflect on my own childhood and my parents' parenting style. I've always felt like I lost a lot of my childhood because of not having a present father and having to be dragged to political meetings and rallies and things. And obviously there was a point in my life later on where I was very, very grateful for that. So I have no doubt she's going to push against this at some point, that she's been overexposed to the reality that is South Africa. And I always have a conversation with friends who are educational psychologists to talk about this very thing that Koketso mentions, like how much do you protect your child from the world? Yeah. Like your child needs a sense of safety and security to be able to be confident, but you can't also raise them in a bubble, because then when they see the real world, it's a fuck up. So the thing for me is that I worry that she is exposed to a lot of nonsense. But I think the good thing is that there's a lot of spaces that are outside of mainstream media where people are organizing or creating collectives or thinking. So it's not the kind of big fees must fall shutdowns, but the smaller collectives of people who are meeting and thinking through things and arranging art projects and different kinds of things that she also gets exposure to. Yeah. So that form of activism, I think, is useful, because she also gets a sense that it's possible to do things even when there's this overwhelming sense of injustice out there. But the thing around the class differentials, I mean, Lerato's, we've taken her back to the children's home where she where we adopted her from. She gets it, man. She knows that this is where she comes from, and that actually coming into our family means that things have changed dramatically for her. But I mean, Lerato's almost the perfect undercover revolutionary agent, because I promise you, she goes to my dad in Lavender Hill, which is a violent, problematic neighborhood on the Cape Flats. And she changes the way she speaks English, and she knows what's going on. She goes to middle-class West Coast Oregon, where my partner's family's from in the U.S., and she can fit in there. She can fit in a range of different places. And we also, I mean, the good thing about Joburg, which I'm worried about not having as much access to in Cape Town, is that in Johannesburg, people have a sense of ownership of the city regardless of where they live in it. So we've really been able to nurture friendships with people from across the class, race, sexuality spectrum, which has been really useful. And people who are confidently understanding their position in terms of the structural conditions that exist. And for her to have access and for us to have access to that has been really useful. Again, coming back to this point of, we can't teach her everything by telling her what's going on. Yeah. It's actually choosing diverse and difficult relationships, friendships, and situations that will create those learning opportunities for her. So she knows very well what's happening.
It sounds like it. And I think something that's come from across from everybody is that there's a, when you allow it, there's a real sophistication and understanding of complex ideas that can happen when exposed to and when allowed. Unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I'd like to say a deep thank you to all of you. I know the family and the child is a really personal thing, so I thank you for, you know, being open to coming on and speaking about something so personal and being open around what you're grappling with, what's working really great, what's still not quite there yet. And yeah, it's a massive thank you. Like I said, probably just a start to the conversation, and I'm sure we'll continue this, maybe have the kids on in a few years, but it's just a thank you. Tanaima Potsa, Koketsu Moeti, Leah Naidu, massive thank you to all of you. Okay. Everybody tuning in, this is the Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. Please download and share the podcast, and as always, we look forward to hearing from you on Twitter. Thank you.
The Daily Maverick Show on cliffcentral.com. This is cliffcentral.com.